Ground.
Produced by 2SER and Guardian Australia for the Community Radio Network.
Welcome back to Common Ground, the podcast where we try to understand what's happening in the electorate by listening to four Australians as different as we could find them, in conversation about life and politics and everything with leading social researcher Rebecca Huntley. I'm Lenore Taylor, editor of Guardian Australia, and in this second episode, we talk to our participants about the big economic dividers in Australia. Economic inequality, the gap between rich and poor, the gap between the generations, between genders, between city and country, what that means to them and the communities where they live, and what they think about some of the policy ideas that have been put forward to solve those problems. Politicians sometimes make the answers to these kind of issues sound neat or simple. Our participants were definitely concerned about inequality and about those sorts of economic divisions. But they were often also very concerned about whether people had come to expect too much from the system, from life.
So there's a coalition parliamentarian called Andrew Lamming, and he said that inequality is staring over the fence and noticing another guy has a jet ski and you don't have one. What do people think about that comment?
I hate jet skis.
Does anybody, first of all, should anybody disclose, does anybody have a jet ski amongst the four of you?
Boo no, if you do.
Do not have a jet ski.
No one's enjoying the jet ski except the person on it. Everyone else is annoyed by the noise.
Yeah. Katrina, do you have a jet ski?
No.
No. Sharon?
Absolutely not.
All right.
There you go.
What do you think he's trying to get at with that comment?
Well, I think that he's trying to get at the idea is like, well, when people look at inequality, they see someone has a nice thing that isn't necessary, and they would like that nice little luxury as well. But really, I think he's like an idiot because the gap, because it's not about, oh, well, we're all living a comfortable middle-class lifestyle. We're all out in the suburbs. We all have our fancy houses and everything's good, but, you know, my neighbor Steve, his barbecue, it's amazing, whereas my barbecue, it's from a few years ago, it's not as good. It's inequality is the gap between the richest and the poorest, and that keeps getting bigger. And inequality isn't the jet ski. It's people who don't own a house, people who will never own a house.
Katrina?
You know, there's a difference between needs and wants, and a lot of people don't seem to understand the difference. There are a lot of people who get themselves into a financial situation of their own doing. And what I mean by that is they see things that they want that they see as needs, like smoking and alcohol. And I'll just tell you, I grew up, my family was extremely poor. My family couldn't afford. We had no shoes when I was growing up and I didn't go to school. My mother taught us at the kitchen table and my grandmother paid for my an education for me and my two sisters. So, and I have grown up and really valued what I have and I really value and I have been a total saver all my life because of it. And so I just find it really difficult thing because I just see people wasting money on unnecessary things. And then I also see people who are in circumstances not of their own doing who are really struggling.
When the Reserve Bank governor gets up and gives a speech and says, wage inequality is getting wider in Australia, social inequality, which he's done a couple of times in the last couple of months, If you were to take him on face value, what do you think would be causing that?
Well, as you know, a lot of companies have got bigger and bigger, and you know, as they increase their profits, then they should be also increasing wages. Like I just think if their workforce should be participating in the extra profits that they're making. So you know, I believe in that, but I also believe we shouldn't be being brought up to feel entitled. That we should actually try and be self-reliant.
Okay, I'm going to bring you here, Sharon.
This country's in a lot of debt, and I think us as taxpayers are very demanding. And I think a lot of it, especially young people, like, I guess, oh, we've got to save the world, we've got to do this, we've got to do that. We've got a scheme for people with disabilities. We've got amazing things in this country, we really have, that a lot of other countries don't. But there's a big demand for it too, and sometimes I think people are too demanding, and I think that most of that comes back to they don't know hardship. We don't really know hardship, our generation. Well, Katrina does, but I think if you look at our grand people, the next generation up, and the next, they lived through the Depression, and so they've lived through hardship, so they're much more careful with their money. I think a lot of it, that where we are as a country is we've had it pretty easy.
In terms of looking around your community and looking at what's happening with, let's say, your son's generation and so forth, do you feel that they've got as much opportunity for things like a permanent job?
No, probably not much chance of buying a home now. It's changed. It's changed very quickly. It really has. So, yeah, no, they don't have the opportunities. Yeah. I think things are getting harder. Things are definitely getting harder.
So if things are getting harder, what do you put that down to? Do you put that down to the choices that they're making, or do you put that down to something else?
I think wages aren't increasing like they used to. They're not keeping up as they used to. There's not as many permanent jobs. Housing's so expensive. Everything's so expensive. We're taxed more. I think we are taxed more.
Josh, to reflect, where do you see the whole issue of inequality in your community?
Well, you see it everywhere because you've got massive unemployment, like compared to the national average. You've got underemployment as well, an equally big problem. You've got drug use by a lot. You've got these tiny houses that people can barely afford to keep. And if they can, they can barely afford to keep the lights on. And then meanwhile, across town, you've got a new development coming up where people build their nice four-bedroom homes, and they come and they settle in. They come from the cities or wherever. And
buy jet skis.
They buy their jet skis and then they take them down to Lake's Entrance. It's just everywhere.
And what do you put that down to? Like, what do you think is causing that?
Well, a lot of that locally came from the mine, because the mining jobs were really well paid and there were a lot of them. But then when the SEC was privatized, there were a lot less mining jobs. Contractors were getting paid less. And then you had the situation where a whole bunch of people were just sort of thrown out into the wind. And then, when that happened, they couldn't hold on to as much, and the whole overall wealth went down. So the people who could hold on, they could continue to live the lifestyle that they'd gotten used to, but everyone else, they were forced to cut back dramatically. And the reason inequality is growing, like just generally, and will continue to grow, is because of the way that we approach production. Like, it's, if you own something, then you fundamentally have just a head start, because when people go into work, they will create a certain amount of value, and then they'll get paid a portion of that value back in a wage, and the rest becomes profit. And there are business expenses and such, but when the government in the 80s decided to go down deregulation and cut down those costs as much as possible and make it easier to set lower wages, then you had a lot more of the value produced could end up going to the people who owned.
Steve, inequality, is the gap between rich and poor getting bigger in your view from what you see in your community, and what you think's causing it, if you think it is getting bigger?
With me, I feel like definitely my life, my real wage has gone up a bit, but I think it's just as I've got older, as I got better at spending, as I've earned a little bit more money, it's got better. But as opposed to whether inequality has grown, I just don't know. In that situation, I'd be more so asking someone like Katrina, who's been around for and got a lot more life experience than me, has inequality grown over time? So I could say, in my life, I haven't really seen it much, but I can't speak for other people, and I can't speak for people who working class families who've got a mortgage and all that sort of thing.
Okay. I want to get Sharon and Katrina to respond first to the idea about, do you think that there's more gender inequality in terms of economic inequality? Do you think it's harder for women to do better than men in the current economy and labour market that we live in?
I don't think there is, actually. I think it's probably easier for women at this point in time because there's a real push for women upper management and higher levels. And I don't know if it's gone the opposite way, but it's been a boys' club for so long that there is a real push for women.
Well, I mean, I was quite aware of the fact that women get paid about 20% less for doing the same job in corporations, and they don't seem to have the same advancement opportunities that men have. I mean, there are not a lot fewer women on boards than there are men. And so I mean, I work in the agricultural industry, and it's really interesting. I work in the sheep industry, and if you want to see a bloke's club, come to my town. It's unbelievable, absolutely unbelievable, the sheep industry, in terms of women getting opportunities to do, you know, whatever in the and if you look at things like the Merino Stud Breeders Association, I think there's only ever been one woman on the board. You know, it's all men. And nearly, there are thousands of studs in Australia, sheep studs. There's only probably about a handful of women that run them. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's just, I've been working in the stud industry for years and years, and I've never had a guy in the stud industry ask my opinion.
Really? I want to get Josh and Steve to reflect on whether they think there's a gender element to the economic inequality question.
Well, I do think that it exists as you go higher. But at the moment, looking around me with, you know, the kind of people that I'm friends with and hang around with, we're all young. So we're only earning like minimum wage in service jobs. So that doesn't really exist there yet. But I do believe that as we get older, it's something that you start to see.
Do you think that there's a generational aspect to inequality?
Yeah, I do think that generational gap is there for a whole bunch of reasons, because the workforce is becoming increasingly casualized, because it's becoming harder to find a job and a house. Just in general, the economy is, it feels like, taking a turn for the worse, and that leaves more young people more desperate, and the more desperate they are for work, the more they're willing to accept unsafe conditions or less pay than they should get. The less they're going to be conscious of, you know, wage theft and looking out for that, because when you put people in precarious situations, survival comes first, and then trying to improve your situation comes second.
Does anybody else violently disagree with Josh on that?
No.
Well, I mean, it's Katrina here. I'd just like to make a comment about, you know, one of the hardest things for young people and the generational inequality, I think, is housing affordability. And I mean, it's been, you know, it's been in the media, been done to death, but it's basically a supply and demand. And I think that everyone, you know, we're a huge country and we've got a population of, you know, 25 million people, and the majority of our population lives in three cities, and everyone wants to live in the city. And Sydney's getting bigger and bigger, Melbourne's getting bigger and bigger, and Brisbane. And I know housing is cheaper in Brisbane than it is. And people say, well, they're the only, you know, places where I can get a job is in the city. But it's pushed housing prices to the limit because there's a shortage of supply, because governments haven't planned well enough out into the future for creating, you know, more housing supply to fulfill the demand. And that, you know, that's where the pressure has come on young people to try and afford to buy a house. And I think it's put enormous pressure on young people. And the housing prices, they're some of the most expensive in the world now in Sydney.
So, Katrina, if Josh wanted to be able to afford a house, could he move to your community and get a job? Like, he'd probably be able to afford a house, but is there a job and a life for him in regional or rural Australia?
Well, it depends on what his qualifications, and I mean, there are you know, the bigger regional centres, they certainly, I'm sure, have got jobs available. I think in our particular little town, because it's only a small town, you know, maybe not. But in the bigger regional centres, there are jobs available. I just know that.
Well, mind you, yeah, I am sorry. I'm not exactly in the city right now.
No, you're not. You're not. Okay, I'm going to mention some various policy ideas that have been put forward to tackle this issue of income inequality. Scrapping negative gearing.
Bad.
Sharon, why is that?
Because it feels like, because a lot of mum and dad will do the negative gearing and it's a little nest egg for them, and it just feels like they're trying to keep people down. That makes sense. Like, I know Labor wants to take away. Bill Shorten talked about that, and it's like, that's just a little, you know, people work hard and they don't have a whole lot of money, and they be sensible and save a bit. It's a nest egg, and I just feel like they're taking that away from them.
Katrina?
Well, I'm a bit of, you know, in two minds about negative gearing, because there are a lot of people who just offset income, you know, paying tax on high income, and, you know, buy a property and negatively gear it, and they get a tax benefit for doing it, and they accumulate property in the process, and that can have an influence on property prices. And I understand what Sharon's saying about the mum and dad saving really hard and trying to, you know, invest in some property, but I don't know. I'm of two minds. I don't think that people who are trying to spread out their income and get, you know, a big tax advantage by negatively gearing is a good thing.
Sharon, what percentage of people who negative gear do you think are the mum and dad investors? Any idea? The majority, half, a third?
No, they're the only ones I know.
Right. So you know some people like that, I understand. Yeah. And what do you think, Sharon, or really anybody else, about with negative gearing, instead of getting rid of it, how would you feel if, let's say, you could only negative gear one property or limit the number of properties you could do it?
I like it.
You like that idea?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense as a compromise, because when you're getting onto like your fourth investment home, you're a lot less likely to be a mum and dad investor at that point.
Yeah. You might be parents, but you're a different. You're not what we think about when you think about a mum and dad. Yeah.
A different kind of stereotype there.
Steve, do you have any views on this?
I mean, to me, limiting to one property, as Josh said, seems like a good, happy compromise to me. Like, yeah, I'm just on surface value.
What about the idea of a universal basic income? So it's the idea that the government would pay a flat fee to every adult citizen, regardless of his or her engagement in learning and working. So this idea that it would actually substitute for current welfare and social security programs. So it wouldn't be on top of that. This idea that everybody, no matter who you are, would be guaranteed a certain amount of money from the government.
Bad idea.
Bad idea. Why is that, Josh?
Well, I agree with it in principle, but at the same time, when you have big, you know, like with automation coming down the line, and UBI is always talked about as, you know, a solution for inequality and for automation, because it means that people who lose their jobs to automation, well, they've still got a way to survive. But when you've got a big, you know, like these concentrated producers, you know, companies, and then you rely on their output in order for, you know, citizens to survive, that's feudalism by another name. And in my mind, it is a dangerous idea to give corporations that much power, that they have, you know, less people working for them, but more, you know, they produce the same amount with less people working for them thanks to automation. And then with the UBI, you've got, you know, them that taxing them in order to get the money for the UBI. I just see it as a dangerous idea that puts a lot of power into the hands of corporations.
Anybody else like the idea of a universal basic income?
I would say it sounds interesting, and it might take some of the complexities out of the welfare system, but I'd like to see how it goes in, I know, was it Finland and a few other countries are trialing it? So I'd be curious to see how they do with it, really.
So, yeah, so I want to think about people projecting into the future. Going to get worse, going to get better, going to stay the same with economic inequality. I'll go to you first, Sharon.
Absolutely worse unless the government changes some policies and steps in. Absolutely worse.
Steve.
I imagine it could possibly, especially if I talk about, say, with my friendship circles and all that sort of thing, it's basically housing and rental prices are going up quite a bit. I guess that digs into your wage a bit, so I imagine that could.
Katrina.
Well, where I live, I don't think it's going to change much.
Now, finally, you, Josh, your views about where economic inequality is going to go.
I think that unless the way, you know, the relations to production, unless that changes, the way that we actually do work, I think unless that changes, you know, you can add, like, band-aid measures, you can try to soothe it, but I think inequality will naturally increase. I think here, in particular, it's going to be, it's going to ramp up everywhere, but here it's going to come like an avalanche all at once. And I think it's going to hit a lot of people.
So can I just make a comment? Did anyone see that documentary on waste? The
yes.
Recycling?
Yeah. On the ABC,
What really annoys me is those people making a fortune out of manipulating the regulations and becoming multimillionaires and, polluting, you know, landfill. And that annoys me. They're people, you know, they're unscrupulous. They've got no integrity. I just don't like... I do not like people who are in business who have no integrity.
I feel like that's happening all the time, like businesses and look what's happened with the Commonwealth Bank, and like everyone's out to make a dollar regardless. Like everyone's trying to cut corners and make a quick dollar like that. That's how it feels lately. Like you can't trust any organisation anymore.
So, Rebecca, is that the kind of conversation you usually hear about these issues of inequality? It was less clear-cut than it comes across in the political debate.
Yeah, absolutely. So in the last 10 years of research, when Australians of all backgrounds similar to our four have talked about this, there's a bit of a push and pull. There's certainly the majority of Australians think that the gap between rich and poor is getting bigger and that it's, you know, that the super rich are getting richer. And they recognise that, and they recognise that there are a range of reasons that that's happening. But when it comes down to what can government do about it, they kind of immediately kind of move to an anxiety that there are certain kinds of people, you know, the people who've managed to game the system, the kind of professional welfare. Mm. We don't use the term dole budgers as much as we used to, but it's essentially people that have been smart enough or savvy enough to game the system and basically get all this stuff from the government and not do much. And so this is really part of the cri de coeur from the middle class, which is that the middle class keep everything going, the uber rich have the great lawyers, which means they don't pay tax.
They game the system in their own
exactly,
particular ways.
That you've got the 1% on either side. When they kind of don't say 1%, it could be 5%, but they know it's a tiny minority number on either end of the spectrum gaming the system, and it's the hardworking middle class that are paying the taxes. And
they're sort of the suckers in the system.
Exactly. They're the ones that are going to be hit with the big electricity prices. They're the ones that are going to be hit with the, you know, all of the rest of it.
And still pay their tax in full without
exactly.
many deductions.
Exactly. I mean, and here's where the contradictions get even more complex, is that when you talk to the very people who are talking about their anxiety about the middle class getting more pressure on the middle class, when you talk to them about so-called middle-class welfare, they're anxious about that as well. Mm. So our views are very much mixed about, you know, how much should government be helping people? How much should we be letting people kind of work it out themselves and support themselves? And who's getting paid? So all of that was reflected in the conversation.
So Sharon and Katrina in particular seemed concerned that in addressing inequality, we didn't lose the expectation that people looked after themselves when they could look after themselves. our women participants were older than our male participants. Is there some kind of generational thing happening there, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, look, it was interesting. It was striking. I wouldn't want to extrapolate too much because, remember, they're also from a generation where the welfare state was much more robust. Mm. Like, so in a sense, you should really be expecting people like Josh and Steve, who, let's say, hadn't grown up with things like free university education, to be a bit more on the self-reliant view. Maybe it is a generational question in terms of both of them, although they didn't necessarily articulate it directly, recognising that their generations had a bit of a raw deal, you know, really high house prices, you know, a retreating welfare state, more education costs, all the rest of it, and less, I think, return from the labour market for higher education. Mm. So all of that stuff has made them say, well, where and are we going to get a little bit more support from the government?
But we know from our first episode that some of the participants are pretty disillusioned with the political system. But then when we threw up ideas about how to address inequality, redistributive kind of ideas, they weren't necessarily always keen.
No, I think that's right. Maybe part of that's about their tentativeness about saying, absolutely, this is a solution when you start to get down to the nitty-gritty of policy issues. So I suppose something like negative gearing is a perfect example. If you're not negative gearing a house yourself and you don't understand the ins and outs, how that works is very much, how you understand that works is very much about the media that you consume. Mm. So if you're consuming media that's always about mum and dad investors, you might be very anxious about getting rid of negative gearing and only support the idea that there might be a cap on how many properties you could negative gear. So I think that when you get down, this is where leadership is absolutely crucial. We can't always defer to the electorate to say, we need you to understand these policy issues in detail and give us a guiding light. Part of it has to be there about leadership and political advocacy.
Thanks for listening to Common Ground. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or with your favourite podcasting app. Thanks to Rebecca Huntley, our podcast editor Miles Martignoni, and our collaborators at 2SER, Emma Lancaster, Taylor Fuller, Miles Herbert and Emma Rappaport.
Common Ground is heard on your local station through the Community Radio Network.